Good evening. Welcome to the Saleri Report. Today is August 1st, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is summertime. It's that time of year when things slow down. The world goes into slow motion. People are out. We're at the beach. We're on vacation. We're reading a book, and the U.S. Congress is in their districts and not in Washington. Wall Street, everybody's out in the Hamptons. In Europe, the Parisians have all gone south. It can feel like a recession, but don't assume it is. It may just be summertime. Let's see what the fall brings. The song says, "Summertime and the living is easy." I'm hoping you're taking some easy time these days. I'm headed up to New Jersey this weekend to record my dear friend and longtime ally, Eunice Boston, this weekend for the Saleri Report. I'll talk about that more as we close. And then I'm on to Rhode Island and Connecticut for a series of business meetings. I will be working, but at least I'll get a chance to see the Atlantic Ocean and to digest a few more Andrew Vax books on tape as I drive. Upcoming events, I'm going to be over at the Polyface Farm, Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund on September 7th. Anybody who wants to be a contributor can come. It's in Southern Virginia. October 4th, 5th, and 6th, I'm going to be speaking at the Casey Summit out in Tucson, Arizona. October 4th to 12th, I'm going to be at the Breakthrough Energy Movement at the University of Colorado in Boulder. One of the subscribers just wrote this week and said that they were coming. Would we organize a subscriber lunch? What a great idea. Yes, absolutely. We will organize a lunch in Boulder. Contiguous with the Breakthrough Energy Movement, and we'll get that up and working and figure out a place way before the conference. So great idea. Thank you, Janet. October 30, I'll be speaking at the annual fall conference of the San Francisco Real Estate and Appraisal Society. I'll be talking about what's next, primary trends in the global financial markets, and the impact on San Francisco Bay Area real estate. Money and markets. Well, we're all Fed watchers now. We've had several years of quantitative easing, and literally we're watching the entire global financial and commodities markets organize and trade off the every word from the Fed. Things got much more Fed watchy in June with the taper tantrums we've talked about. This is combined, of course, the big mystery is when will quantitative easing QE3 be over? And that's added to the uncertainty is when will Ben Bernanke step down as chairman of the Fed and who will replace him? The silly business reached a crescendo this week with the number one article in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week being something called Obama's Fed Circus. And the politicking over Ben's replacement really had reached a level of sort of political circus. Lots of people clearly lobbying for Lawrence Summers, the former head of Treasury. And if you look at Summers' role with engineering the housing bubble or the $4 trillion missing from the federal government or the suppression of the gold price, the thought of Larry Summers being the next Fed chairman is just unimaginable, but there you have it. Lots of talking back and forth about that. In the middle of everything, the Federal Court of Claims ruled that Bernanke had to testify in Hank Greenberg's latest lawsuit over the Fed takeover of AIG. That's, to me, really a comment on where things are that Greenberg could be pulled into, or that Bernanke could be pulled into testify in Greenberg's case. But what it means is that the tensions in Washington over this particular appointment and what the Fed does is reaching a new level of tension. And so we have on Wednesday the Federal Open Market Committee meeting for 2 hours and announcing, yes, they will continue $85 billion of purchases every month. As you know, my theory is that they've pretty much pulled in the fraudulent paper, and now it's really a question of when the markets can tolerate bringing the paper in. The market response, the S&P hit 1,700 and above for the first time. If you look at the charts, and let's look at the charts, Justin has some great slides and charts up on the Instant Teleseminar if you're watching, and I encourage you to take a look at them. But if you look at the charts, not much else is doing well. The media keeps highlighting how well the S&P is doing, and so we tend to have a notion that the markets are doing well. But just about everything else is struggling. Bonds are struggling. Gold is, and precious metals are staying down. The emerging markets are down as the pendulum swings back to the development markets. Dr. Farrell, in the interview that we did with him this evening, we talk a lot about that pendulum swinging back and what it's about. China has announced that they are doing an audit of government debt. That includes all their local government agencies. That's a very big deal. China's legal and financial infrastructure is widely distrusted on the world stage. And if you've ever spent any time in China, you would understand why. The Chinese are very, they're extremely entrepreneurial, but they can run ahead of the kind of legal and financial infrastructure you need. The new leadership really does seem bent on reform, and if they are successful and manage to get real sort of financial and legal controls in place for the kind of infrastructure you need to grow the growth potential that China has, if they're successful in that, and Chinese infrastructure, particularly the intellectual infrastructure, becomes powerful, it's going to really help fuel China as a new global leader. Anyway, but the local governments in China borrowed heavily as part of keeping growth going during the financial crisis. The last audit published in 2011 showed the local government debt at U.S. about $1.7 trillion, and that number is a very important percentage of total bank lending in China. So an audit of the local government units is going to have a big, or could have a big impact on the banking sector in China. China is not the only federal government hitting on local governments. We are watching a tremendous effort in the United States to, at the federal level and at the leadership level, to really go after state and local governments and pension funds in a way which is highly political and not anywhere near based in the facts and evidence, I think. Part of this is kicked off by using Detroit as a whipping boy. There's a new and very, of course, we have Detroit in the equivalent of bankruptcy, and all sorts of things are going on. But the financial manager now has wide latitude to do many things in terms of the obligations to retirees and to the unions. And it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. This effort to target the pension funds has big implications, not just for retirees, but for local taxpayers. Because the pension contributions could go far in terms of how they hit the budgets and how that hits services. So this is something that has impact for all of us. And finally, there's implications for the municipal bond market. We see Meredith Whitney back on the financial press talking about the extent to which the municipal bond market could be impacted. If you haven't listened to the interview we did, Joe Mysak from Bloomberg, on the municipal bond market, very much worth listening to. I think a much more measured presentation. But we do have municipal areas that are in trouble. And if anything, the reason they're in trouble is because of bad behavior on the federal government's part. This is a little bit like watching the rapist blame the victim. We had the financial coup shift assets out of the country in ways that really harmed the municipalities. Of course, the municipalities were encouraged to do all sorts of bad things during the housing bubble, which bubbled their revenues. And but the burst left them in trouble. It really left the pension funds in trouble, who'd bought a great deal of the mortgage paper and, of course, have big treasury positions, treasury securities, so they've been drained by the debasement as well. So the fraud bubble's engineered by the federal government, and then the debasement and the lowering of interest rates to finance the federal government have both drained the pension funds. At the same time, a lot has been done to stabilize most of them. And if you look at their problems, I would say the last thing contributing, or very low on the list contributing to any financial problems, is profligate spending on the behalf of state and local employees. So it's very interesting. Michael Hudson had a piece recently where he pointed out, you know, every time we say there's no money for retirees, we don't seem to have any problem coming up with trillions to give away to the banks or to fund war in the Middle East. So there is a double standard in terms of when we do and do not have money. It's one of the things that Dr. Farrell and I talk a lot about in the interview this week, the idea that we're leaving the state, and not just state and local, but the retirement obligations in the old legacy systems over on one side of the economy, and then we have a financial coup d'etat that pulls $40 trillion out and puts it in the new economy, a.k.a. the breakaway civilization, and suddenly, voila, there's no money. But, of course, there's plenty of money to finance all the things going on over on the new side. The Economist had a series of articles this week, and including great... If you want to do a hit on the state and local pension funds, they did a very slick job. It's not backed up by the facts, but it's certainly very slick. One of the things they mention is the quote-unquote vibrancy of the private sector versus this clunky, old, inefficient, corrupt government. If you look at the real facts of the case, the amount of money that has been used to subsidize or transfer assets at below market value to the private sector to create that vibrancy is absolutely enormous. And the thought that somehow government is inefficient and the private sector is vibrant and efficient is so in defiance of the facts that it is, as my uncle, who used to be a colonel in the Army, would say, it's stupefying. Just remember, government has had a negative return on taxpayers because it's funding a very subsidized positive return over there in the quote-unquote vibrant private sector. Not to say that there aren't a lot of wonderful things going on in the private sector. There are. Science and technology. I finally was inspired with our wonderful production team to sit down today and write a little piece called Out of Control, Control. The efforts to control the population are really completely over the top. You almost don't know what words to find. I struggle to find words to communicate how just out of control it is. There was a series of different stories, and I wanted to bring them all together. We have the NSA, of course, for the last several weeks telling us that they can listen to anything we say and keep a record of it through whatever medium, and all sorts of internet and social media also do the same, and of course through the back door provided to the NSA. Now, and you'll see these stories up on the blog, we have Harvard and members of the scientific community saying that they can direct the thoughts of animals and also implant false memories in people. Now, what this means is that there's all sorts of technology to influence or insert thoughts and cause us to act in various ways, but it also means that enforcement agencies or courts can call up experts to testify that our testimony suddenly is not the case. They're false memories. Now, you think that's bad enough. Now we have DARPA slapping out contracts to simply come up with ways of inserting new chromosomes in our body and filling it up so that they can reinvent our DNA to their liking and do it not with our permission, but simply just by spraying overhead. And to think that's outrageous, I sent my little post on Out of Control, Control to John Rappaport, and he wrote back and he said, oh, DARPA is also pursuing a mind control project to detect how the brain accepts or rejects propaganda narratives of events. Now, all of this, of course, is being funded with our tax dollars, which makes it all the more amazing that we're financing literally, I just don't even know what to say about them. But check out that blog post, because it's, if you ever thought that the situation wasn't out of control, there it is. The hit on the IRS continues, and if you've ever been frustrated with paying taxes, don't fall into thinking this is a good thing. When you get these kind of political efforts to really work over an agency like this, if anything, you're going to end up with an agency that's much more political You know, this is a condition that creates a lot of fear, and when that happens, lots of things, crazy things can go on, but it's one, it'll be very interesting to see where it goes. You have efforts in Congress to come up with major tax reform. Again, I certainly don't think it's going to go anywhere this year, but we'll see what happens. Wall Street's role in stockpiling commodities keeps coming up. A number of articles posted on the blog. And it's interesting that it's doing, because generally those stockpiling helps to prop up prices. Of course, commodities, another asset class completely in the doghouse. And it's interesting to see that it's happening when commodities are really at the bottom. Finally, one headline, and I just have to bring this up because to me this is one of the most shocking stories I've ever seen. Homeland Security has announced that they are building their new headquarters at the St. Elizabeth site in D.C. And I literally, I'm going to have to give you some background to describe this story. St. Elizabeth was a mental institute in Washington, and it was a mental institute that off and on has been the subject of investigative reporters pointing out that some very scary and unusual things have been going on there. One story, for example, is Kelly O'Meara's story of she studied the people who've been buried at St. Elizabeth's. You had a lot of patients who died there, didn't have families to take care of their burial arrangements. They were buried at St. Elizabeth's. And what she went into the National Archives and discovered that they all seemed to automatically die 6 months magically after they'd entered St. Elizabeth's. And she came to me and said, what could possibly explain this? And I said, what could possibly explain this is that the funding ran out from the municipal government to pay for them. And so, you know, they were disposed of. So, but the rumors of things going on at St. Elizabeth's are quite amazing. Anyway, I wanted to read a speech once attributed to Chief Seattle, and this is the end of his speech. It's one I love so much. He said, "When the last red man shall have perished and the memory of my tribe shall have become a myth among the white men, these shores will swarm with the invisible dead of my tribe. And when your children's children think themselves alone in the field, the store, the shop, upon the highway, or in the silence of the pathless woods, they will not be alone. In all the earth there is no place dedicated to solitude. At night, when the streets of your cities and villages are silent and you think them deserted, they will throng with the returning hosts that once filled them and still love this beautiful land. The white man will never be alone. Let him be just and deal kindly with my people, for the dead are not powerless." And I would say to the Department of Homeland Security, I believe that the dead are not powerless. And if you look at who the dead at St. Elizabeth are, I find it quite remarkable. And for those of us who want decentralization, it's probably a good sign that the Department of Homeland Security will be there, because I would think it'd be a very hard place to build a successful culture. Let me just jump. Bradley Manning acquitted this week of aiding the enemy for giving secrets to WikiLeaks. That's very good news. He was found guilty on other counts, so the legal slugfest continues, but I think that was a very positive development. Kudos to the judge for deciding that. Anyway, that's it for Money and Markets. Hero, a lovely story this week. Two young men on their bicycles chased down a car of somebody who'd kidnapped a five-year-old girl. And so Timur Boggs and his friend Chris Garcia are our hero this week. It's just a really sweet little story. You can read about it. There's a video up over in the Life section. I won't bore you with the details of what would probably happen to that five-year-old girl, but suffice it to say, it's very, very big business to kidnap kids like that and auction them off, and a very profitable business. And so kudos for Timur and Chris for running her down. And it just goes to show you what two kids on a bicycle can do if they put their mind to it. Okay, Ask Catherine. We got a whole bunch of questions this week, and I'm delighted to see that. I live in the New Jersey area, which is plagued with hurricane visits yearly. In exploring alternative power resources, I learned of cogeneration to supply electricity during power failures for extended periods. When you have a moment, I would appreciate your feedback, guidance, in suggesting resources to possibly purchase a residential 5kW cogenerator using natural gas. Any suggestions, comment, guidance is greatly appreciated. We emailed back to, this is from John, we emailed back to John some ideas from one of our subscribers who's the most knowledgeable, in fact, in this business. And believe it or not, one of the things he suggested was eBay, which I thought was interesting because I've done a lot on eBay. It's always amazing what you can do there. In preparation for this broadcast, I was listening to the previous Breakaway Civilization. Dr. Farrell had said what sparked his interest in the Nazis was the vast plunder and plan to exit Europe with said plunder. As I'm sure you're aware, the U.S. and Canadian governments both interned Japanese during World War II. My in-laws were both in internment camps as small children, one in each country. Their families lost everything. Nothing was ever recovered. About 30 years ago, Canada paid each internee $20,000 in reparations. About 25 years ago, the U.S. did the same. Does anyone know what ever happened to all that the Japanese owned? Cui bono. In our family's case, they went from being solidly middle class to penniless for decades, unable to even get jobs or find housing except of the worst sort. Having close relatives who were part of the Nisei Regiment, it was the 442nd, the most accomplished regiment in World War II history, in spite of being largely not credited for it, did not seem to make any difference at all. It's if you don't know that story, it's a remarkable story of one of many, many examples in American history of people's assets being stolen, and not to underestimate the power of many Japanese who were rounded up, or people of Japanese descent, many of them were American citizens, who were rounded up and put in the camps during World War II. An enormous amount of extremely valuable and attractive California farmland was seized because they'd been very successful in high-quality vegetables and other kinds of farming, and had very valuable land out in California. Interestingly enough, I did a paper on this in history at the University of Pennsylvania when I was in college, and it's remarkable the amount of theft and thievery and genocide that has gone on inside of our borders, if you ever sit down and study it. But this is one of the extraordinary examples of just political exploitation and theft, and asset forfeiture is one of the things that's been used to fund a lot of silly business, and it's pretty frightening, some of the things that go on. But that was from Laurie. Laurie, thank you for bringing that up. Question: are you suspicious of something behind the scenes with a train crash in Spain? The answer is yes, but it's one of those situations where you could spend a great deal of time trying to find out if anything really, you know, if it was a covert ARP, and unless you have inside sources, no point in doing it. So could have been an accident or not, no way to tell that I know of. I personally tend to fear that the commodities markets will break, not just the gold-silver market, but also that of oil, food-based metals. At some point, gold may no longer be redeemable for money. If this happens, then the gold commodities exchange may be canceled. The only gold for purchase may only be jewelry. Money then leaves precious metals and goes to the remaining commodities, thus driving their prices and affecting cost of living and core inflation for the public. What then will the commodities exchanges do? Cancel call and put options and force delivery? I have a hard time relating to these scenarios. In my personal experience, gold is so invaluable at the institutional level globally. I just don't see this happening. I do think that if you want to be concerned about a deflationary scenario that hurts the value of precious metals, it's one where new technology explodes out. And in that case, you see the equity markets, particularly sort of the new technology, significantly outperform gold and precious metals, and their values relatively drop, which I think is a possible scenario and one to keep an eye on. But I just don't see gold becoming irrelevant. Dear Catherine, I've followed you for many years and enjoy your articles. Recently, you were talking about the new economy separating from the old economies, and you made an unusual statement about Latin American farms poisoning the American people. What exactly did you mean by that statement, if I may ask? I'm a Latin American farmer, tomatoes, cucumbers, and I was stunned by the comment. That's from Tim. Tim, my apologies. I was speaking to, talking about the food stamp program and speaking with too broad a brush. I was referring to all the GMO food coming in from Latin America. It's also coming in from America, so I didn't mean to imply that it was only Latin America, but a lot of what's getting trucked in from Latin America is GMO, and I think GMO, from what we've seen of the evidence, is really not safe. If you're growing tomatoes and cucumbers, it certainly doesn't apply to you. Another question. My experience with the gold market is that the crazy stories come out at major turning points in the market. What do you make of the recent stories? Bank of England leased 1,300 tons of gold that wasn't there. I don't think that's necessarily a crazy story. We see the Bank of England inventories drop. That surprises me, because if you look at the recent drop in prices, I see the central banks trying to bring in a great deal of precious metals. Yeah, there are a fair amount of kooky stories going on, but if you look at the kooky stories in the gold market, they don't compare to the kooky stories in science technology, which are all true and we just talked about. So, you know, this is a kooky time. A question for Dr. Farrell. Many believe that Israel practically owns the U.S. government. However, we have Joe Biden, who is thought to be a Vatican man. The Vatican is now led by a Jesuit pope. Given that both groups are enormously influential politically and financially, please could you comment on any power play relationship between the Jesuits and Israel? Has one infiltrated the other? If you look at the last 500 years, you see a wide variety of institutions and sort of tribal networks competing and cooperating, and three that are often referred to are the Vatican, the Israeli and Jewish networks, and of course the Freemasons, and then you have all sorts of conglomerations of royalty and aristocracy and elites, various sort of groups. Rappaport, in some of his early audios, Mind Control, Mind Freedom, does a very good job of describing these, and these groups always cooperate and compete. So have they infiltrated each other? Yeah, they've been doing that for 500 years. So I would say yes, but it's very old and very organic. Another question. When you briefly spoke on Obamacare and the changes coming down the pike, it was as if you were reading my mind in regards to wondering what our choices are. My husband's and my particular health insurance plan is being discontinued as of December 31st. We just don't know what to do next and rarely see doctors or get prescriptions inside the system. I'm asking if you might consider spending a little time on this topic on a Salary Report this fall. I would love to hear an expanded version of things you mentioned, AAA and the options in private funds, where participants pull their money for the purposes you mentioned regarding potential medical costs. Great question. I can't tell you how many times on our roundups and our strategic planning meetings the Salary team has spent trying to figure out how we could do one or a series of Salary reports on what our healthcare options are. Part of it is we've been searching for somebody who could explain Obamacare in an hour or less, which is quite a struggle. And of course, watching the evolution of what's happening with Obamacare is part of this, because it can go in different ways, and so the number of potential scenarios are great. I did mention earlier on a Salary report that I do get extra coverage through AAA for car accidents. I drive a lot, so obviously it's important to have health care insurance for car accidents and transportation accidents, which is the one time I'm likely to use the sort of traditional medical establishment is under a situation where you have trauma, so something like a car accident. I am a member of Samaritan Ministries, which is a cooperative group of Christians who underwrite each other, and it's a remarkable organization, remarkable group. It's limited to Christians, but if you would qualify, I would definitely check out Samaritan Ministries. And then It was this subscriber who suggested that we have a subscriber lunch while we're in Boulder in October. Great idea. So that's what we'll do. Interview. We posted this afternoon my interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and there's two parts in the background on this interview, which is a very important one. First, we did an interview last year on the breakaway civilization. This one is Breakaway Civilization Part 2, but I was so inspired by my first conversation with Dr. Farrell last year that on my way back from California, I stopped to talk with him and one of his co-authors, Scott DeHart. Both of them were at Oxford. Both of them are incredible scholars and amazing in the depth of their research and interest in the world. These are two intellectually very curious people. And we had dinner and talked for about 5 hours one Saturday evening, and then the next day I came back and we systematically talked about many of the issues we talk about in this interview for another 5 hours. And I left California very inspired. That was in the end of June. And one of the reasons I felt so inspired is I pride myself on seeing the big shifts coming. And I did a very good job of anticipating what was happening with the financial coup d'etat and encouraging people to take steps, including with gold and silver, to protect themselves. And then I saw the 2008 coming and was able to encourage people to step aside in the stock market and in most risk assets. But I didn't see the fall coming in April in precious metals, and that was really disturbing me. And I felt as though my map needed a much stronger infusion of information about what's really going on and where things are going and what that means to the economy and what it means to the economy both globally and here in North America. And so and in those 10 hours, I left California saying, okay, I think I have it. And then I drove back across the country and watched how the economy was performing in the agricultural areas, in the oil and gas areas, and then in the areas which are building up the new high-tech manufacturing that we talk about in this interview. And I really felt like, okay, I have a very good framework for this next period. And so that's to be tested, and there's a lot to be filled in. So I went back after recording in 5 hours in California. I said, well, we can't do this. We can't put up 5 hours. So I called Joseph back and said, okay, can we do a summary, executive summary interview for 2 hours? And that's what we did. And we cover a lot of the questions of this division we watch going on in the economy between, you know, the legacy systems with the retirement and healthcare liabilities and a new breakaway civilization that is going gangbusters and is very, very resource rich. What is this all about? What does it mean to the economy? Where is this going? And so, and of course, what does it mean to us and what can we do about it? And so we've posted that today. It's the kind of thing if you can download and listen to if you've got a long drive, I would really encourage you to do so. It also dovetails with interviews that I did with German reporter Lars Scholl, who did for Matterhorn. Matterhorn put it up today. We'll have a link up on the blog, and then a video with USA Watchdog Greg Hunter on the same topic. He keeps having people on USA Watchdog who are saying the economy is going to collapse tomorrow. And, of course, that's just not what I believe. I think we're in for more slow burn. And that's not to say that the part of the economy, depending on the legacy systems, isn't going through a collapse. It is. But I would say it's a very controlled, I would say it's a controlled demolition more than a collapse. Okay, let's go to the movies. I chose for Let's Go to the Movies this week two documentary series originally done for television that are very useful in helping you understand what is happening in the North American economy right now. The first one is called The Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, and it was produced by the BBC. And it is the story of seven remarkable engineering or infrastructure projects that were financed. Most of them are 19th century. The Hoover Dam is 20th century. But it gives you a sense of the power and importance of major engineering feats to the development of the economy, the development of places, and the development geopolitically of different sovereign governments and empires. The second one is called Engineering and Empire, which is much longer. It was produced by the History Channel. It's not of the same quality of Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, but it does a very good job of marching you through the relationship between major in engineering and infrastructure and the development of different empires throughout the ages. And part of what you're seeing now in North America with the sort of building of a high, a distributed manufacturing capability that is taking advantage of a series of different developments. One in robotics, one in fabrication technology. 3D printing is one of the more commonly known developments in fabrication, and one in material sciences. And when you take these three together, you're talking about an absolute revolution in manufacturing, and you combine it with what is being also done in parallel in the in energy and domestic greater domestic provision of oil and gas and renewable energy, and what's being done in agriculture. And you are coming into the building of a whole new infrastructure. Now, we have yet to see exactly how all this is going to unfold, but we see many of the bits and pieces of it. And when you look at what's being developed here, it's very helpful, I think, to go back and look at how empires have grappled with building these kinds of infrastructures and building the kind of manufacturing they need to accomplish their purpose. And Dr. Farrell and I talk a little bit and speculate a little bit about what that purpose may be. I think some of that purpose is going to the next stage of the privatized effort to really build out into space. We see Silicon Valley entrepreneurs talking about mining asteroids, and if you look at what's happening in the mining industry on planet Earth, actually it makes a lot more sense than you might think. The other reason I wanted to recommend these to you, particularly Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, is that I think one of the most unfortunate aspects of the one-way mirror and so much secrecy around the black budget is that the great feats of engineering and many of the greatest inventions and accomplishments that are going on this planet are secret. And so we don't get to celebrate them. We don't get to be proud of them. I'll never forget in the early days of the space program when we put a man on the moon or when we would accomplish various things in the NASA program, you really felt the pride of being part of something that was another step forward in the development of the human, of the human civilization. And we don't get that sense of pride these days. In the Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, there is one story of the seven that is by far my favorite. And it's the story of Robert Stevenson, grandfather of Robert Louis Stevenson, who most people know, the author, who sort of invented and persuaded and for the commitments to be made to build the Bell Rock Lighthouse in Scotland. And I think he led the effort starting the year after literally 70 ships had floundered or crashed on the Bell Rock. And it's an absolutely remarkable story of the power of intellect and the power of vision and the power of the kind of imagination that John Rappaport talks about, and of what one person can do to literally make an extraordinary and dramatic contribution to the human race and to the economy, because imagine all the businesses and how much money and lives are lost when 70 ships get shipwrecked, and that's only in, I think it was, that was only in 1 year. So we're talking about a world where one engineer can literally, envision and implement a project, and it can make an enormous difference to countless lives, countless families, a country, and many, many businesses. And I would love to see us live in that world again, where we could envision doing that, and where we could have alignment between communities and people and businesses sufficient that not only can we do those things, but we can be inspired by them and we can celebrate them as a society. So I found it extraordinarily inspiring to watch, and I would just pray that we take the time to understand and celebrate some of those accomplishments today, because they're certainly happening, but we don't see them and we don't celebrate them in the way I think that we once did. So if you feel like doing it, I would check these out, particularly Seven Wonders of the Industrial World from the BBC. Okay, well, that's it for this week. In closing, we have some very exciting Solaria reports coming up, and I just want to take a minute and tell you about them. August 8th, we have Open Source Ecology with Marcin Jakubowski, who's the head of he's the head of Open Source Ecology, who is designing what's called the Global Village Construction Set, open source blueprints for the 50 machines and tools you need to invent, build, and operate a civilization without having to be dependent on Mr. Global. It was such a remarkable conversation that after we finished doing the Solaria report, we just kept recording, and I gave him a little briefing on the MIT Project Management System, which we'll also post up. And I ended up participating in the design sprint that Marcin has. He and OSE do a design sprint every week or two, and everybody gets online and starts designing tractors and permafracture curriculum and all sorts of other stuff. So he's somebody who's really doing a remarkable thing to help build a decentralized economy. And I think he's going to receive a lot of support from the powers that be, because if you're trying to build a decentralized manufacturing infrastructure, you certainly want it to be fashionable. And you certainly want lots of young people getting in there and learning how to make things, because, again, you're going to go to something far more distributed. So I think there's a very interesting alignment happening between all the innovators in the military. You want to bring the price of a jet fighter way, way down, if not make a spaceship more economically feasible, and what Marcin is doing to help communities rebuild. August 13th, Coming Clean, Transforming Lives Through the Power of Cleaning. I'm a person who's extraordinarily interested in cleaning, and one of the reasons is Eunice Boston, who runs a remarkable company called Partners in Grime, is a very dear friend of mine and taught me about cleaning. And when I started Hamilton Securities in Washington, I insisted that Eunice start a subsidiary in Washington and hire up and become the cleaning company for Hamilton Securities. And it was that decision that saved my life. And I'm going to tell you the story of how Eunice Boston and her cleaning team, in fact, saved my life. Just remember, when you walk out the door of your business every night, you leave behind incredible information and value in the computers, in the files. So you just do not want anybody in the cleaning company to come in. And so the Partners in Grime story is a very interesting one. Then August 20th, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, back for the second time on the Solaria Report. We'll be talking about the strategic issues facing the U.S. military. If our entire economy depends on the value of the dollar, and the dollar being the reserve currency, because we control the sea lanes and the satellite lanes and have the most powerful military in the world, it pays to understand what's happening in the military. Wilkerson is the visiting professor at the College of William and Mary, teaching courses on U.S. national security. But, of course, he was the chief of staff to Colin Powell and has been the man who's been most forceful in calling Dick Cheney a liar, which takes a lot of courage. So Wilkerson is a remarkable man, and so we're delighted to have him back. Okay, so until next week with March and Jakubowski on the Global Village Construction Set and Open Source Ecology, please remember, don't worry about whether there or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.